And thanks for coming. Kurt Shannon, the Executive Director of Arizona Mining Reform Coalition. And I'm here to introduce Dr. Stephen Emmerman, PhD geophysics and world-renowned dam expert. And so I'll just turn it over to Dr. Emmerman.
Okay, thanks to everyone for coming. Everyone can hear me okay? Okay, great. So I'm Stephen Emmerman. Thanks for the introduction. My presentation is entitled, How to Turn Fresh Water into Toxic Waste. The Resolution Copper Project is a case study. Now, I know that this audience is mostly interested in fresh water, but one thing I want to emphasize is that in terms of industrial mining, fresh water and toxic waste are inseparably created. That is what fresh water is used for, why it's consumed. It's consumed in the production of toxic waste. And that's what I'll be explaining. Okay? This is not the Resolution Copper Project yet. This is the Berkeley Pit in Montana. Okay, next slide. And okay, we'll start here. Okay, now. I want to explain the big ideas to start with, and then I'll be working through the details, okay? I call this the chemical reaction of industrial mining. This is basically what industrial mining does. It takes fresh water and a landscape, and I'm including the ore body as part of the landscape. From that, it produces toxic waste, plus a degraded landscape, plus some commodity, like copper, gold, iron. Okay? Now, as I said, toxic waste is the driver for the consumption of fresh water. So these two components of the chemical reaction must be discussed together. Okay, I'm going to start off talking about toxic waste, and then I'll move into consumption of fresh water. But I want to explain why they're connected, why you don't have one without the other. Next slide. Okay. So I said you take fresh water, you consume that, you produce toxic waste, you degrade the landscape, and you get something out of it. Copper, for example, okay? Is that commodity worth the price? That is copper mining a good idea or is it a bad idea? Well, it's not a simple question. You have to ask lots of questions, okay? Who benefits from the commodity? Who suffers the damages from the production of the commodity? Who bears the risks from the production of the commodity? Is it the same people who benefit and who suffer the damages and bear the risks? And finally, who's making the decision as to whether the commodity is worth the price? Not simple questions. Okay, next slide. Okay, now, this is connected with a very modern and very ugly idea, which is called the sacrifice zone. And no one likes to understand that they're the sacrifice zone. This is a sample definition. The sacrifice zone is fundamentally a geographical concept about the production of space. Environmental harms are concentrated in some places in order to protect the environmental health and sustainability of other places. Geographies of environmental sacrifice have been the necessary corollary of geographies of environmental abundance. The latter depend on or constituted by the former. In short, the sacrifice zone concept signals a we who are singled out for some criteria as an acceptable sacrifice, and they use the powers of state, market, and mindset to do both the rationalizing and the sacrificing. Next slide, please. Now, it's a new concept, this idea of a sacrifice zone. And it's not a very nice concept. And I'm saying I don't agree with that concept. That is, no one and no place has any obligation to serve as someone else's sacrifice of. And I say this is a new concept because we don't find any world religion and any traditional religion that includes this concept of a sacrifice of, or that justifies this concept. Next slide. And we've fallen pretty far from traditional religion when we say it's acceptable to demand that someone else serve as a sacrifice of. This is from the past president of Geological Society of America. As for me, I accept the degradation of part of our environment for the betterment of the whole to get sufficient energy production to keep our society functioning and bring health, electricity, and better living conditions to the rest of the world. So although to some it might seem callous, no need to call him callous, he's saying that himself, I accept the loss of the pristine deserts in South America to get the lithium we need. But it will be lost, and probably has to be lost, unless we find another way to build Teslas and other batteries. Of course, it's all about what Tesla needs. Next slide. I'm again asking this question, how far have we fallen? It is now acceptable for someone to demand that someone else serve as a sacrifice of. This is an email sent by CEO of Nova Copper to the mayor and council of the Cape Breton Regional Municipality. This is in Nova Scotia. Communities that do not welcome safe, responsible copper mining will be abdicating their responsibility to act on climate change. He's telling their municipal council, it's your obligation to offer yourselves up as a sacrifice of. I don't like this. Next slide. Okay, now with that introduction, I want to start talking about the nature of modern mining or industrial mining. And the first point here is that the ore deposits that remain in the world are heavily depleted. And I'm saying that on a global basis. If we would look, I don't think I have a pointer. I'm just going to use my finger. So look at that top diagram. If we would go back to about middle of the 19th century, a copper ore meant it was like 25% copper. And now we come to the present time. Average copper grade is 0.64%. Gold is incredible. 0.8 grams per metric ton. 125 years ago, it was like 50 grams per metric ton. When we think about the high-grade ore deposits of the ancient world, King Solomon's mines, all the mines they talk about in the Bible, those are long, long gone. And that's just the nature of the world now. Next slide. So if most of an ore body is not copper, well, what happens to the rest of the ore body? It becomes what we call tailings, which is toxic waste. Why is toxic? I will be explaining later. Okay, so what are tailings? They're the wet, crushed rock particles that remain after the commodity value has been removed. Now, typically, these tailings are permanently stored behind a dam constructed out of the mine waste. Okay, next slide. There's another kind of mine waste called waste rock. That's the rock you have to remove to reach the ore body. On a global average, for every ton of copper ore, you have to remove 1.86 tons of waste rock to get to the ore. Meaning for copper, the waste to metal ratio worldwide is 513. And it's much greater for other commodities. You know, typically, to produce a ton of copper, you produce 500 tons of toxic waste. Next slide. Okay, so what's the problem with so much mine waste? What can go wrong is the catastrophic failure of the tailings storage facility. Just because this material is so wet and so fine-grained, it's very liable to collapse. Okay, on the left, Mount Polley Mine, British Columbia, Canada, 2014. Release of 24 million cubic meters of tailings with destruction of salmon habitat. Middle, Samarco Mine, November 2015, release of 32 million cubic meters of tailings, 19 deaths. The tailings flowed for 637 kilometers until they finally flowed into the Atlantic Ocean. on the right Cohego do Feijão mine, Brumadinho, Brazil, January 25th, 2019, release of 9.7 million cubic meters of tailings, 272 deaths, which was 258 mine workers, and 14 bystanders. Think about these numbers. In the middle, 32 million cubic meters of tailings. So do a comparison in a bit. Okay, next slide. Okay, resolution compromise. Skunk Camp Tailings Storage Facility. Just for reference, note on the right, you can see the red arrow pointing to Skunk Camp. You can see Santan Valley on the left side of that diagram, okay? Permanent storage of 1.37 billion tons of toxic tailings. Remember I said Samarco 32 million. So now we're multiplying that by about 40 to get Skunk Camp Tailings Storage Facility. Dam would be 490 feet high and 3 miles long. This dam is not a concrete dam that you might be used to. It's constructed out of the toxic tailings themselves, which I'll be saying more about. Next slide. This was a presentation given by gentleman Peter Werner, senior mining engineer, U.S. Forest Service. In the 2023 presentation, which is available on YouTube, he explained exactly the procedure by which the Skunk Camp Tailings Storage Facility is going to fail. He's one of the preparers of the final environmental impact statement. This information in this presentation is not available in the FEIS, but as I said, it's on YouTube. Next slide. Okay, so I would just play the presentation, but that never seems to work, so I'm quoting it. Let's go down to the desert where Resolution is proposing to put its tailings impoundment. Right there at the bottom of the drainage, blocking all of those side drainages, this thing at full build-out is going to be about 4,000 acres. Distances across it are measured in miles. It's going to contain 1.4 billion tons of tailings. The design is to route all of the run-on from surrounding areas over the top of this thing, which you can see in the diagram, and out a notch over by the left abutment. What makes this especially problematic is that they are nesting 220 million tons of highly concentrated pyrite tailings. That is the most toxic of the toxic tailings in the center of this thing. So this thing needs to be very robust and immune from any kind of degradation. So it's explaining exactly what's going to go wrong. Next slide. Okay, now this information is in the FEIS. It predicts that after failure of the Skunk Camp facility, the tailings will travel 268 miles with a range of 83 to 868 miles. That's not from me, that's from the U.S. Forest Service. That's exactly taken from the FEIS. This is crazy, 868 miles is just based upon the size of this facility. 1.37 billion tons of tailings and 490 feet high. That distance, 868 miles, is not the absolute worst case scenario. It's what they call the 75th percentile. Next slide. Okay, now, 868 miles, well, the tailings flow along the Gila River to the Colorado River. They reached Mexico after going 425 miles. You go another 85 miles and the tailings have reached the Gulf of California. Now, based on the fact that this was just the 75th percentile, in 40% of model outcomes, the tailings will travel to the Mexican border during the initial event. In 36% of model outcomes, the tailings will travel to the Gulf of California during the initial event. But it doesn't matter what happens during the initial event. Whenever that ends, normal fluvial processes, normal river processes, will transport the tailings all the way to the Gulf of California. This is really a massive amount of toxic waste. Okay, next slide. Now, important feature of tailings storage facilities is that they're permanent. What am I contrasting this? If you have a water retention dam and you don't need it anymore, or you can't carry out maintenance anymore, you have to completely demolish it. You can't just abandon a dam, or at some point it's going to collapse with consequences difficult to predict at some unknown time. Okay? Either you maintain it or you dismantle it. Those are your choices. That's the truth for any engineering infrastructure. You maintain it or you dismantle it. But a tailings dam has to contain its toxic waste forever. It can never be dismantled. Is it going to be monitored, inspected, maintained, reviewed forever? If not, all future generations will have to worry about the eventual collapse of the tailings storage facility. This is why tailings storage facilities are called a curse on future generations. We're always going to have to worry about that facility. Next slide. Now, this is not just me talking, and I'm not taking this out of a Greenpeace publication or something. This is the mining industry position. Now, this is Tailings Management Handbook put out by Society for Mining, Metallurgy, and Exploration. It's the premier mining industry association in the U.S. This is from the very first chapter. The mining industry has a significant challenge in that these tailings storage facilities will last for perpetuity. Unfortunately, humans have no experience in designing facilities to last forever. So responsible tailings management is required for as long as the TSF, tailings storage facility, exists. Next slide. Okay, now the U.S. Forest Service has the same position, which was only announced last December. This is the December 2025 issue of Mining Engineering. This is the cover story in that magazine. The U.S. Forest Service recently conducted a risk assessment of a mine facility on National Forest System lands, including the Failure Modes and Effects Analysis, FEMA, methodology. The FEMA showed recurrent natural processes such as wildfire, storm runoff, vegetation succession, slope creep, freeze-thaw cycling were the principal drivers behind eventual reclamation failure over an extended time horizon. This is due to the incremental degradation of individual component performance leading to more acute non-performance and eventual system-wide breakdown. The FNEA participants concluded that the natural processes that drove risk would always be present and would slowly degrade the reclaimed facilities over time. The only solution to maintaining system performance was a commitment to site care and maintenance, well, forever. There is no expiration date on reclamation integrity, and mining companies should recognize their post-closure care and maintenance obligations may last far longer than they have currently planned for, and in some instances may be a forever proposition. And this article is also written by one of the preparers of the FEIS for resolution cover. Next slide. Now, I'm going to another gentleman here, Professor Stephen Vick. He's the author of Planning, Design, and Analysis of Tailings Dams. This is the standard textbook on tailings dams. If you study mining engineering, this is the textbook you'll use. He goes a step further. He says, regardless of anyone's intentions, just accept the fact that tailings dams are going to fail. Just accept it. He says, for closure, system failure is inevitable. Okay, this is some slides from Professor Vick's presentation. He asks some questions, he answers them. One, over what duration should the closure design remain effective? Effectiveness is unlikely to be maintained much beyond 100 years. Two, how effective should it be? What system failure probability? System failure probabilities much less than 50-50 are unlikely to be achievable over performance periods greater than 100 years. Three, what return period for design events is consistent with one and two? Even for return periods associated with maximum credible earthquake and probable maximum flood events, system failure probability approaches 100% after several hundred years. He concludes, for closure, system failure is inevitable, probability approaching 100%. So closure risk depends solely on failure consequences. Next slide. This was a conference paper by the same professor, Stephen Vick. System failure must be accepted as inevitable, regardless of the return period selected for design events. The cumulative failure probability will approach 1.0, 100%, for typical numbers of failure modes and durations. This has major implications. For closure conditions, the likelihood component of risk becomes unimportant, and only the consequence component matters. This counterintuitive result for closure differs so markedly from operating conditions that it bears repeating. In general, reducing failure likelihood during closure through more stringent design criteria or otherwise does not materially reduce risk, simply because there are too many opportunities for too many things to go wrong. In a statistical sense, all it can do is push failure farther out in time. System failure must be accepted as inevitable. It means catastrophic failure of a tailings storage facility must be accepted as inevitable, leaving reduction of failure consequences as the only effective strategy for risk reduction during closure. Next slide. Okay, but in the Resolution Copper FEIS, there is no plan for perpetual maintenance. There's certainly no budget set aside for perpetual maintenance. There is not even the bare minimum, what we would call an emergency preparedness and response plan. Okay, now some of you might know the DIS, the Draft Environmental Impact Statement, promised that the Emergency Preparedness Response Plan was not ready yet, but it would be given in the final EIS. And the final EIS said, no, it's not going to be here. This is what the final EIS says. This is by the same U.S. Forest Service that said perpetual maintenance was necessary. However, full emergency planning is premature, given that those efforts are specific to the downstream residents and community, and the facility would not begin operation at best for at least a decade. Why that matters, I don't know. This remains a requirement for any facility built on federal land. And while this would not include alternative six, that is the prepared skunk camp alternative, why not? Well, because if Resolution Copper gets the land, it's private land, it's not federal land any longer. And nothing USFS wants matters anymore. Emergency planning also is a specific requirement of the recently adopted Global Industry Standard on Tailings Management. It's an industry standard. Alternative six, that's their preferred alternative. As the facility would ultimately be located on private land, the Forest Service would not have authority to require these specific design standards. They're saying once it's on private land, once Resolution is on, Copper's on private land, none of these standards matter. Next slide. Okay, now, water. I want to distinguish between three things, which are often people use them interchangeably, and actually the FEIS does, which I'll point out. Water use versus water consumption versus water footprint, okay? Now, water use is the rate at which water circulates through the mining operation. Any mining operation recycles water, and that rate is the water use. We are more concerned with water consumption. That is the rate at which new water has to be brought into the mining operation. The rate at which makeup water is withdrawn from groundwater or surface water sources. Okay, so why do you need makeup water? Because water is being lost due to evaporation, it's being incorporated into mine waste, it's being incorporated into the end product, like a copper concentrate, or it's being returned to a different watershed from which it was withdrawn. Water footprint is a bigger concept. It includes the water consumed in generating electricity, manufacturing reagents, etc. But I'm going to stick with water consumption. Okay? Now, what I've given you here is the industry definition, and I'm going to tell you that's incomplete. Okay? The reason I emphasize this is that in a bit, I'm going to compare what Resolution claims, what they claim for how much water they consume. And I'm going to say that's not consistent with the industry standard. But I'm saying even what the industry calls water consumption is incomplete. Okay, I'll explain. Next slide. Okay, now here's a way of thinking about water consumption. Is that water consumption is water that has been taken away from some other consumer, that is a person or an ecosystem. Now, what if I have an open pit or underground galleries, Resolution Copper, okay, quite a large pit, block cave operation. Water flows into that, okay? Here's an example, Lobo de Ouro mine in Brazil. It's 5 kilometers long, it's 2 kilometers wide, it's 400 meters deep. Wow, that's quite the pit, okay? When you have a temporary shutdown, that pit completely fills with water. Kinross Gold pumps water out of that pit. They don't need a permit that. They don't report that. They don't count that as water consumption. That's just called their water, even though water is flowing into the pit from the surrounding aquifer and being taken away from other groundwater consumers. So that's not counted as water consumption. Next slide. What else is not counted? Water that's returned to the environment or left in some degraded, unusable state. Okay, here's the pit lake at the Anaconda mine in Nevada. That water is not good for anything. It is so toxic. It continuously evaporates, continuously draws in more groundwater. The consumption and degradation of water is continuous and permanent. That's not counted as water consumption by the mining operation. It should be. Next slide. Okay. Precipitation onto the mine site surface, runoff onto the mine site should count as water consumption, but it typically is not. Okay, this is from Rio Tinto mine in Madagascar. They say there is zero water consumption. That diagram clearly shows precipitation and runoff onto the mine site. That's water that would be used by somebody else if the mining operation weren't there. That's not counted as water consumption. Next slide. Okay. If you pump out water from one aquifer and you re-inject it into a different aquifer from which the groundwater was drawn, that should count as water consumption, but it often is not. Okay? Well, it should be, because it's water that's taken away from someone else. Well owners withdraw water from a particular aquifer, not just from groundwater in general. Also, nearly all aquifers discharge into surface water, a stream, a lake, a wetland, a spring. A particular aquifer discharges in a particular surface water body. If you take water out of that aquifer and you return it to a different aquifer, you've taken water away from someone. Okay, now not everyone agrees with this. The Utah State Engineer has ruled that re-injecting wastewater into a different aquifer from which it was withdrawn does not count as water consumption, which I think is quite absurd, okay, which I've already explained. Okay, next slide. Okay, often consumption of brine does not count as water consumption, but it should. If you pump brine out of an aquifer, that causes fresh water to move into that briny aquifer from other aquifers, freshwater aquifers. Also, most brine aquifers discharge somewhere at some surface site, a saline spring, stream, a wetland. When you don't count this as water consumption, it's really like saying some natural occurring water body is nothing, or it's useless, or waste. Okay, so to summarize, a lot of what should be counted as water consumption, you're not going to see in a mining company report as bare water consumption. Next slide. Okay, now, This is that connection between toxic waste and fresh water. So what's happening at this tailings storage facility? Here's an example from Spain, a mixture of Rio Tinto mine in Spain. A mixture of water and tailings from the ore processing plant is hydraulically discharged from the crest of the tailings dam into the tailings pond. That mixture is, by mass, 35% solids and 65% water. Okay, next slide. Okay, now in that tailings pond, the tailings settle out of suspension and the supernatant water is pumped back into the mining operation. Okay, so what's going on here? We have a huge evaporation from the tailings pond, and as the tailings settle, they're permanently entraining water. Those are the major sources of water consumption. That's how fresh water is being consumed at an industrial mine. It's being used in the generation of toxic waste. That's why I took so much time to talk about toxic waste to explain that point. Next slide. Okay, so in the FEIS, we have predictions of water consumption. Alternative 6, that's preferred, Skunk Camp. Skunk Camp remains the lead agency's preferred alternative. This alternative would need about 540,000 acre-feet of groundwater pumped from the desert well field through the life of the mine. Where is this desert well field? Sometimes called the pumping wells, recovery wells, the Marco Corridor, the desert well field, same place, okay? So what is this? 540,000 acre-feet of water. That's a little hard to visualize. That's 80,000 average Arizona residents over 40 years. Next slide. Okay. But in their general plan of operations, they plan for even greater pumping capacity. The current recovery well field design consists of approximately 30 wells with a capacity of approximately 400 gallons per minute, each along the Marco Corridor between the Central Arizona Project Canal and SR-79. Okay, so that's now 774,000 acre feet. That's the water consumption by 118,000 Arizona residents over 40 years, and all of this is way too low. Next slide. Oh, before I talk about me, I'll talk about the Arizona State Land Department, okay? So this is their letter from last August, and they objected to this amount of groundwater pumping, even though I'm gonna say it's gonna be much more. ASLD has significant concerns with the draw of an estimated 544,858 acre-feet of groundwater in the Superstition Vistas planning area over the life of the mine. 6.7% of all the groundwater available in the entire East Salt River Valley, much of which is state trust land. The project's groundwater withdrawals will have significant adverse impacts on the regional aquifer underlying 275 square miles of state trust land. The FEIS modeling of alternative 6 shows a maximum drawdown of approximately 200 feet in the center of the well field below current water levels, with declines of approximately 100 to 130 feet at its edges. This pumping associated with alternative 6 would decrease the likelihood that groundwater could be used for new development in the future as hydrological and legal contexts continue to evolve, adding additional groundwater depletion to an already stressed groundwater sub-basin. The value of the as-yet undeveloped state trust lands would thus suffer, with the potential additional water supply obstacles to already committed uses, which could delay or eliminate demand for state trust lands. Okay, next slide. Okay, they are now quoting the FEIS as saying the groundwater depletion would be irreversible. The final FEIS estimates that alternative 6 would result in roughly 24 to 50 inches of subsidence, that's subsidence of the ground level, 4 feet of subsidence, within 2 miles of the desert well field, which encompasses approximately 20 square miles of state trust land. The final EIS reasons that subsidence will occur where groundwater withdrawal causes the water table to drop below its historically recorded lows. The removal of this water will cause the compaction of the earth from which the water has been removed. Moreover, as the final FEIS acknowledges, subsidence is irreversible. The state is just quoting the FEIS in this regard. The ground will not return to its prior level, and the ground will not be able to store as much water as it had previously. The ongoing processes of subsidence and the potential formation of earth fissures in the subsidence area presents a risk to the future development of the land and the value of state trust land in the area. As noted in the final EIS, earth fissures can directly damage structures as well as infrastructure, including roads, utility lines, wells, and canals. Okay, 4 feet of subsidence. Next slide. Now, that's the question I'm asking. Is our Santan Valley and Resolution Copper competing for the same groundwater? It certainly looks like it from this diagram. Okay, that red dashed line shows where the wells will be to pump groundwater for Resolution Copper, and in purple, you see the incorporated area of Santan Valley. But my question is Resolution Copper even being realistic in predicting its water consumption? And I'm saying no. Next slide. Okay, so this is my report. I said Resolution Copper has underpredicted their water consumption by a factor of about 3. Rio Tinto has estimated water consumption as 15,700 acre feet per year and a possible maximum of 20,000 acre feet per year. However, based on the grade and production rate, water consumption of 50,000 acre feet per year would be more typical for the copper mining industry. Okay, but I'm saying that in terms of what a copper mine would report as its mining consumption would be 3 times what Resolution Copper is saying. But keep in mind that what a mining company reports is not all the way the water is consumed, as I've explained. Although Rio Tinto states that the mine will be operated to maximize internal water use, the general plan of operations proposes only conventional technologies for water efficiency. That was my report in 2019. Next slide. Now, the FEIS said Emmerman's right, Emmerman's right except for this one flaw. Okay, so that's important to consider. What's that one flaw they're going to make? Now, notice one other thing else is that throughout this quote, the FEIS says water use, where the correct phrase is water consumption. The point made by these public comments is that this disclosed water use, 16,682 acre feet per year, is less than that predicted by Dr. Emmerman from literature estimates, 50,000 acre feet per year. A review of the same literature sources used by Dr. Emmerman confirms the point made. Resolution Copper water use as disclosed is less than would be anticipated based on other mines. Okay, so far they've completely agreed with me. However, Emmerman fails to examine why this difference exists, but instead assumes it means the disclosure is flawed. The data sources used by Dr. Emmerman fail to account for the type of tailings. That is what they're saying is the one flaw. Specifically, the Resolution Copper project is using thickened tailings, ranging from 50 to 65% solids, compared with 20 to 50% solids in a conventional tailings slurry. The review of the Emmerman report demonstrates that the water difference identified by Dr. Emmerman is due to use of this technology. In other words, the Resolution Copper project uses less water than other mines because the proponent has incorporated enhanced technology, that is thickening, in order to reduce water use. Okay, so let's examine what they have called as the one and only flaw. Next slide. Okay, actually conventional and thickened tailings consume the same amount of water. Now, let me explain. If we look at this diagram here on the left, that's what's coming from the mill or processing plant. 30 tons of solid tailings and 70 tons of water. That's coming out of the ore processing plant. Now, go over one to the right, conventional tailings. What's happening at the tailings storage facility? 30 tons of solid tailings will settle out of suspension, and with them, they will entrain about 7 tons of water. The rest of the water floats at the surface to make a supernatant pond, and that's pumped back into the mining operation. Okay? What if we look at thickened tailings? All of that mixture, again, is pumped to a tailings storage facility. We have a distinction that about 18 tons of water is removed at, excuse me, some of that water is then removed before the whole mixture is shipped to the tailings storage facility. Sorry, it's a little hard for me to read back there. Okay. So if we look at under thickened tailings, at that very top, that dark blue, we have 35 tons of water is reclaimed during processing. Okay? So some of that water stays at the ore processing plant, and the rest is shipped to the tailings storage facility. What happens at the tailings storage facility? 30 tons of solids are shipped out, suspended, they fall out of suspension. They entrain with them 7 tons of water. The rest of the water floats to the surface, makes a supernatant pond, and is pumped back into our processing plant. Okay? Meaning that you're still entraining the same amount of water with a given number of tons of solid tailings. You still have a surface water pond, so you still have the same evaporation. You're not going to get significant water savings until you go all the way to the right, what's called filter tailings, where you thicken the tailings so much they're now like a moist soil, not a slurry, and now there's no surface water. Okay? So conventional and thickened tailings consume the same amount of water. Meaning if that's what they're finding is the only flaw, then I'm right, then they're wrong. Okay? Meaning what Resolution Copper has predicted as their water consumption, whatever they predict, multiply that by a factor of 3. I said the mine is going to be like a town of 120,000 residents over 40 years, multiply it by 3. They predict a drawdown of the water table of 200 feet, multiply by 3. They say they'll use 6.7% of the water in the aquifer, multiply by 3. They say 50 inches of subsidence, multiply by 3. Next slide. Okay, now, what about these toxic tailings anyway, okay? Let me explain that. What's called acid mine drainage. That's on the left. That reddish-brown water, that's the discharge from dam drainage pipes. It's after the water's been treated. These are my picture, photos. If we go about a kilometer downstream, we have the village of Santa Rita, and that's the water from their hand-dug wells. It's exactly that same color as the water coming from the dam drainage pipes. Next slide. Okay, so quick tutorial. What's happening in acid mine drainage is pyrite is combining with oxygen and water to give us dissolved iron plus sulfuric acid. This is the basic idea. A sulfide ore body contains sulfide minerals. These are typically stable when they're beneath the surface. Exposure to oxygen turns the sulfide minerals into sulfuric acid. When that happens, it releases the heavy metals that were part of the crystal structure. We now have increased acidity in streams. This causes release of heavy metals attached to the stream sediment, so we get a positive feedback. And of course, all of this has a detrimental impact upon municipal and private water supplies and aquatic health. Next slide. Now, there are no examples of sulfide ore mines that have been operated and closed without environmental pollution. Now, the reason I come to this conclusion, that's a report from me, is that there have been 10 mines, sulfide ore mines, that people have said they've been operated and closed without environmental pollution, but they all actually have extensive records of pollution. Next slide. Now, the Skunk Camp facility would separately store PAG, that's potentially acid-generating tailings, and what they call NPAG tailings. Now, you might assume that NPAG means non-potentially acid generating, but it actually doesn't mean that at all. It's just an acronym. Because this is what the FEIS says. Samples of the tailings we call NPAG in reality are classified roughly as 15% acid generating, 41% non-acid generating, and 44% potentially acid generating. Use of the term NPAG does not mean there's a complete lack of acid generating capacity in these samples. NPAG is just an acronym, like KFC or something, okay? It doesn't mean it's non-potentially acid generating. Next slide. Okay, however, after the FEIS admits that, they then treat these NPAG tailings exactly as if they were non-acid generating. That is, what's the dam going to be made out? The dam is going to be made out of NPAG tailings, which they say are acid generating. So the dam itself that's going to confine this tailings pond, that dam itself will be an uncontrolled source of acid mine drainage. In order to keep the PAG tailings from turning into sulfuric acid, they'll be kept underwater, but not the NPAG tailings. And gradually, the PAG tailings will be gradually covered with NPAG tailings, meaning we're treating them as if they're non-acid generating after acknowledging that they really are acid generating. Next slide. Okay. This is what my students would always say, Dr. Emmerman, doesn't the world need copper? Oh, and we go on and on with that list of what the world needs. Battery metals, rare earth elements, hydrogen bombs, hypersonic missiles, artificial intelligence, etc., etc., etc. No end to what this world needs. It's this word world that bothers me. Because when people say the world needs, they're acting like the world is some kind of giant community meeting where everyone has an equal voice, everyone shares equally in all benefits, harms, and risks. But the world is nothing like this, and it's not how decisions are made in this world. Political decisions result from interactions among political actors, often with profound differentials in power. So how does a mine happen? Mines exist because those who will benefit from the mines tend to have more power than those who will suffer the harms and bear the risks. Next slide. Okay, so in terms of who would benefit from the Resolution Copper Mine, I don't mean to give a complete answer, but just a few things to think about. Of course, Rio Tinto is the owner of Resolution Copper. Rio Tinto is not a U.S. company, it's a British-Australian company. The largest shareholder in Rio Tinto is Chinalco Aluminum Corporation of China. That's a Chinese state-owned company. The copper concentrate that would be produced by the Resolution Copper Mine, and that copper concentrate would include the critical minerals indium, silver, rhenium, tellurium, and bismuth. It would include the DoD strategic material, molybdenum. All of that would be shipped to China for processing, and then it's Chinese. China could then sell, or they could choose not to sell the refined copper plus the other critical minerals and strategic minerals back to the U.S. That would be a Chinese decision. Next slide. And thank you very much for listening. If you would like the slides, feel free to ask me. Okay, I'm just going to correct one spelling mistake and then you'll get exactly this. Or if you want to contact me with any questions, feel free. And I can give you my business cards, you know, need to write down this email address. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
I should also say that the slide presentation will be put on the Arizona Mining Reform Coalition's website, probably not tomorrow, but in the near future.
I'm just going to correct it. First.
I have one question,
but Sylvia, I hand up first.
There are other problems with this mine down in the Santa Valley area. There's problems with what people that live here, with the railroad, and the people that live here need to find out where that desert well field is located. It's on state land. The filter plant and load-out facility is 550 acres of private land, and it's going to be close to Castlegate, not too far from there. And so it's going to affect the railroad that's going to be coming through at least six times, let's see, six trains per week with 100 railroad cars. The water, I know Dr. Edelman spoke about the water, but you're going to be pulling out 540,000 acre feet from that desert well field that is right close to us. That's over 175 billion gallons of water over 40 years. So, also, that copper slurry pipeline that's coming from Superior, it's 22 miles coming this way. It's got roughage in it. There is no pipe that will withstand the test of time, not break, and cause an environmental damage down here. So that's something else to think about. There's going to be noise, there's going to be vibration. Some of the streets that are going to be affected are Western Star Road, Mid Road, Phoenix Road, Attaway Road, and some of these other roads. Not only is there going to be more traffic, like we don't already have enough traffic, because of the construction that's going to be going on, there's going to be more noise. This filter plant is going to run 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And I got all that information out of volume one, which is one volume out of six, that was put together for resolution copper, and it's called the Final Environmental Impact Statement. So,
I would like to respond, please. Okay. Thank you, Sylvia. Okay. So Sylvia pointed out a lot of this information is available in the FEIS, but I want to talk about some things that aren't in the FEIS. Okay. Yes, you're correct that all of that copper concentrate will be pumped through 22 miles of pipeline to a loadout facility where it's then loaded onto rail cars. Okay. The FEIS talks about the likelihood of failure of that pipeline. I mean, the pipeline rupturing and just spilling the copper concentrate onto the ground. Okay. All of that is vastly underestimated in the FEIS. Okay. They come up with their estimate by referring to failure rates of oil and gas pipelines. And even then, they don't consider all causes of failure. They only look at failure rates that are caused by earth movements, like earthquakes or landslides. And those are not even the most common causes of failure of either oil or gas lines or cadence pipelines or concentrate pipelines. You have some additional impacts from concentrate pipelines. First is that you got the solid material inside the pipeline that's corroding the pipe from the inside, which you don't have in oil and gas pipelines. You also have an awful lot of water, and that is causing all kinds of reactions resulting in corrosion from the inside. Okay? So for many reasons, we should expect the failure rate of the concentrate pipeline to be much greater than the state of the FEIS. In the report that I wrote for the court, this is my review of the FEIS, I'm forgetting the exact number, but something like I said that the probability of failure of a concentrate pipeline was over 90%, meaning it should be expected. Just be expected that at some point that concentrate pipeline is going to rupture. And at least I saw in the press that Assistant Attorney General for the San Carlos Apache said that exact same thing during the last hearing. Okay. Otherwise, everything Sylvia said is worthwhile, but when she says water and she gives a number, I still say multiply that by three. Okay, yeah, thank you, Sylvia. Okay, you got a question?
Well, I was just curious of how many people, like before this meeting or here in the knew that this is where Resolution was going to get the water.
No.
That knew that they were getting the water from here.
No.
Because I just find, you know, that we've heard about resolutions for years or decades, but this water thing is new.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I think the lady here had a question.
Well, I was just rearranging some of the information. How do we access that? I'm just looking for that online through the.
If you go on Resolution Copper, you put up Resolution Copper Mine, they will have a link on there to the FEIS. Or if you get the name, I can send it to you a link directly, because it's 6 volumes.
And this will show the deck, like the railroad and the well.
You'll see a lot of maps with the railroad and stuff. So, there's a lot of information.
And if you want my review of the FEIS, which is way short. I think it's about 75 pages. Okay. You can ask me for that. Since it was submitted as a core document, it's public. I can't say where to find it, but you can just ask me. Okay, yes?
So this information is very alarming and eye-opening. What can we do to stand up against it? Are we too late?
I would like to turn that question over to Robert.
I'll handle that. I'm Roger Featherstone, Director Emeritus of the Arizona Mine Reform Coalition. This is by no means a done deal, and people need to really keep that in mind. What we're arguing about right now in court is whether Rio Tinto Resolution Copper would get title to 2,400 acres at Oak Flat. If Resolution Copper somehow managed to do that, it does not give them even one permit. There are federal permits for the pipeline, the power line corridor. There are state permits for water, for air pollution. And then neither the board of directors of Rio Tinto, 55% owner of the company, or BHP, 45% owner of the company, have given the approval to move forward with this mine. In fact, what they're waiting on is should by chance Resolution Copper gain title to Oak Flat, they would then spend several years writing a feasibility study that would determine to the board of directors whether or not the project is even worth moving forward with. If that feasibility study is anything more than a greenwashing exercise, it will clearly show that this mine is not technologically feasible for many reasons. So there is a chance that, a very good chance, that if they do this feasibility study, the companies would say, no, we don't want to sink money into a rat hole. Of course, the bottom line there is, if there isn't public opposition, the boards will say, what the hell, we'll go ahead with it. So it's the squeaky wheel kind of a situation. So there's federal permits, there's state permits, and then there's the companies themselves not making the decision. This is not a done deal, and there's a ton of people, of things that people can do to make sure that it doesn't happen.
Yeah, you can go to the Arizona Mining Reform Coalition website, or if you signed up on the sign-up sheet, we have an activist list, action alert list that you'll be put on.
I think I was going to build a warm body, but I think I'll take some more questions right now instead.
What I have been led to believe that groundwater depletion, regardless of what it's used for, will lead to ground settling. This is something I've studied for a while, and this information has been very valuable in that it does in fact cause ground settling. is something that we definitely have to think about, and that aquifers being robbed from will short the people that are downstream, and the ground settling will happen there also. This looks like a big domino effect, and losers are the property owners, not the mining operations, because they walk away. I also understand that when mining sulfide ore bodies, the only way to eliminate acid runoff or acid formation in the air or water is not to expose the sulfur, copper sulfide, or sulfur-containing minerals to air. There are very few ways to do that, but one way definitely works, and that's to leave it on the ground. Do not unearth it. Do not make us live with the mess that is left. Water that can't be used. If anyone has ever heard of Kearney, Arizona, I encourage you to research what their drinking water is like. Unpalatable. They have to pay for water to be brought in from elsewhere. So I am telling you, this stuff is real. It is not imaginary. This is very educational. It puts the effect right here where we live. And I don't think any of us in the Copper Corridor or even in the state of Arizona are safe from this type of assault. If we don't feel it, our children definitely will. Thank you for your time.
You said all that so well.
I know. He has 35 years of experience working in the mines and as well. So it's not like he's talking without knowledge.
No, I understand. You said all that perfectly. So thank you, and I don't have anything to add to what you said. Yes.
First off, thank you so much for taking the time to speak tonight. Definitely very educational and very much appreciated. I have two questions, if that's okay. My first question is, with these tailing dams and kind of the eternal process of degradation that we'll see, who ultimately is responsible to maintain these dams? And if that agent ceases to exist, what party then takes control and responsibility of managing?
Okay, so that's a very good question. Okay, so we say, who's responsible? So we say, after closure of the facility, who's responsible for maintaining that? And if that party does not carry out their responsibility, like they just leave or they declare bankruptcy, who takes that over? Okay, so the first answer is, who's responsible for maintaining that after closure is nobody. Okay? Nobody's responsible. Okay? The FAIS explains that. I'm forgetting the exact number, but something like that they'll monitor the facility, something like 10 years. Okay? But then it's nobody. Okay? And after they leave, who takes that over? Well, nobody. There's no plan for this. There's no budget for this. Well, who's gonna pay for this? Okay? It's kind of the sort of the contradiction of modern industrial mining is you have a mine that operates for some finite amount of time and produces some finite amount of commodity, and then you have a massive amount of toxic waste that requires maintenance forever. Okay? How much does it cost to maintain something forever? I don't know. Okay, a lot. Okay. So is it worth it? Is it worth it to get copper now for 40 years and then have a tailings storage facility that needs to be maintained forever with nobody having the budget to pay for it? With nobody being responsible to paying for it, with even the author of the textbook saying just accept that failure is inevitable, Okay, is it worth the price? Well, I'm saying that I don't want to say never, but let's consider, well, who's benefiting? And now, who's bearing the risks? And is it the same people bearing the risk and getting the benefit? And who's making the decision, the one benefiting or the one bearing the risks? Those are the questions you have to ask, okay? But there's nobody that has these responsibilities. Oh, okay, I'm gonna answer a question you haven't asked. I'm gonna ask it for you, okay? Does a tailings storage facility have insurance to cover catastrophic failure? I just put that question into your mouth. What do you think?
It's a great question.
Never.
Yeah.
Never. Yes. That never. Okay. That's regarded as an uninsurable risk. Okay. Keep thinking about that expression, uninsurable risk. Okay. There's no tailings storage facility that has insurance to cover catastrophic failure. Okay. They might have what's called assurance, meaning, you know, they have the money set aside to cover what they expect will be the cost of reclamation, but not unanticipated costs. Okay? This is all kind of the legacy we're leaving for future generations. Okay? Massive facilities storing massive amounts of toxic waste. And who's committing to maintaining them? Who's paying to maintain them? That's all we're leaving for future generations. Okay, is it worth it? Well, let's just ask, who's benefiting? Okay, who's taking the risk? Let's ask those questions, okay?
One more question.
Please, I gave you a question, you can give one back to me.
So in what Sylvia brought up about the railway and the pipeline, obviously there is the imminent risk of this pipeline failing and there being physical contamination. Is there a risk to consider in particulates or aerosolized particulates coming from the transportation of these tailings?
If we would look at, okay, if we look at a rupture of the concentrate pipeline, you're spilling an awful lot of copper concentrate. Of course, highly enriched in copper, okay? It's actually highly enriched in arsenic also. So enriched in arsenic, enriched in copper, it's gonna have a lot of impact on soil, vegetation, etc. Okay? I feel like there was something else you were asking I didn't quite catch.
If there's a risk of, for instance, like the uranium getting railed across the Navajo Nation and the contaminant that comes from that being aerosolized as it travels.
Oh, I see.
Is there a risk if there's failure with the pipeline?
Like, say a train crashes, you know,
with
traveling. That sounds like it's devastating.
Yeah.
On the national news, there have been several incidents with the railroad. One of the last happened in the Midwest where there was a petroleum byproduct that was used for making plastic pipe. Highly flammable. The train derailed because of a failed bearing on a wheel in the train. The president at that time had all of these tanker cars that were hot, fear of explosion. It was decided to rupture the tanks and burn the flammable material. But the black cloud over a huge portion of the state, there was news reports of people, retired people, crying on the ground, because the property is worthless now. So, is there a risk? I'm telling you, history has proven yes.
Okay, thank you. In terms of what's available in the final environmental impact statement, that ends when the copper concentrate is loaded onto a rail car. That ends the consideration of risk. Okay. Now, we could ask a lot of questions like, where's that rail car even going? Okay, that information is not in the FEIS, okay? Just to build on some things I was saying, nothing in the FEIS says that the copper concentrate is going to China. All it says is it's going into a rail car, okay? It's going to China because there's no other place it could go. Okay, there's no other place in the U.S. there's no refining capacity that can handle this amount of copper concentrate, not even remotely close, okay? You have that kind of capacity only in China, okay? The FDA stops copper concentrate on a rail car, that ends their concerns, okay? Yes?
You talked about the subsidence that would be expected from taking water out of the desert well field.
Right.
And I think the Arizona State Land Department mentioned up to 50 inches, which is a bit over 4 feet. And you said to expect triple that, so that would be about 12 and a half feet of subsidence. Would that be limited to the vacant lands east of here, or would it actually come into Santan Valley and Queen Creek and these inhabited areas?
I see, okay. So the information that was stated in the letter from the Arizona State Land Department, they're just quoted from the FEIS. And they're saying, we're concerned by what you see in the FEIS, okay? Now, I think the FEIS talks about subsidence up to 4 feet within 2 miles of that area, okay? To what extent that's going, and that seems to be going into the incorporated area of Santan Valley, okay? I mean, that was a concern about the Arizona State Land Department, is the kind of fissures that would develop, how that could affect roads, canals, infrastructure, etc. I mean, they're probably principally concerned about impacts on their own lands, on the state trust lands, on loss of value. I think part of the letter I didn't quote, I mean, if you ask me, I can send you the link and you can find the whole letter, okay? They talk about what kind of financial hit the state is gonna take by this loss of the value of the state trust lands. They say something like a $600 million hit that they're gonna take, just having lands that aren't worth anything anymore, okay? Now, my continuing concern is that they vastly underestimated their water consumption. That is, the FEIS, done by the U.S. Forest Service, is just taking those numbers provided by Resolution Copper, okay? And that part of the FEIS that I quoted, saying this guy Emmerman is wrong, he's got one flaw, that actually is written by Resolution Copper. It's actually a quote from a Resolution Copper document, okay? This is why I'm saying, as kind of our working guideline right now, let's take everything and multiply it by 3, okay? I am working on a more detailed report on the subject. It will be available in a couple of months. I can be more precise about that, okay? But they say within 2 miles of the desert whale field, let's make it 6 miles. They say draw down the water table 200 feet, let's make it 600 feet. They say you 7% of the water in the aquifer, let's make that 21%. They say subsidence of 4 feet, let's make that 12 feet. Okay, we'll call that kind of a general guideline for now.
Probably everybody in the room is familiar with the earth fissures that are common in this area. And I just wonder if that's a problem that will also be exacerbated by the withdrawal of that water.
You mean earth fissures from?
From groundwater depletion.
Oh, from groundwater depletion. It is common in Arizona. It's common in Utah also, okay? It's common in all areas with Mexico, common in all areas with falling groundwater, okay? We're just talking about pumping a huge amount of groundwater for the purpose of generating toxic waste, for the purpose of generating some commodity, okay? Thank you.
You know, I can't understand how our governor would stand up to, I believe it was the Saudis that were growing straw or hay or whatever. We took their water supply away. Why would our governor or our state governing people approve doing something like this? Because we're not going to benefit from it. The country of China will. But Superstition Vista has been on somebody's radar for a very, very long time. And they plan on developing over there and running a north-south freeway down to Tucson. I really think we should reach out to our governing people, the legislature, the Senate, the governor, et cetera, and push for them to put a stop to this, because this will harm their ability to build the Superstition Vista House and us.
Yeah, for better or worse, when the state improved the groundwater state laws in 1983, the mining companies are almost completely exempt from groundwater pumping. So legally, pretty much Rio Tinto could dry up everybody's wells from Desert Vista, and legally there's not anything that could be done about it. So that's a huge task looking forward, is to remove that groundwater exemption that the mining companies have from our state laws. The second one, though, it's Rio Tinto is not that stupid. They would not go to the point of drying everybody's wells up, because that just wouldn't fly. So there's what they can legally do, and then what they can do according to what we say is their social license to mine. It's definitely something to move forward with as far as what the state really needs to improve. But right now, legally, the company has the upper hand as far as how much they could pump.
I just want to kind of add a bit to this. So there was a hearing last August challenging the land transfer. That's the appeal that was just heard last week, but the hearing in the lower court was this August. So I wrote a report, which you can ask me for, and I'll send that to you, okay? The judge in the lower court asked some very interesting questions. I mean, in the end, he ruled in favor of the U.S. Forest Service and Resolution Copper, but he asked them some very interesting questions. First question said, what if the FAS was just one page written with crayon? Would it matter? And the U.S. Assistant Attorney General hemmed and hawed a bit and said, no, it wouldn't matter. And the something like 15 attorneys for Resolution Copper said the same thing, it wouldn't matter. And then he followed up with another question. He said, what if the FEIS said that, you know what, this project is going to drain every last drop of water out of Arizona, and those tailings dams are certainly going to break with incredible destruction, would it matter? And the U.S. Assistant Attorney General hemmed and hawed a bit and said, no, it wouldn't matter. And the attorneys for Resolution Copper said, no, it wouldn't matter. So they've kind of taken the opinion that it just doesn't matter what the FEIS says. It was just a pointless exercise. Yes, Sylvia? Well, I'm not saying it doesn't matter, okay?
No, but why resolution and
I see, okay. Well, I will answer, and then if I've said something incorrect or you want to expand on that, I'll let you do that. Okay. It's their interpretation of the law that was passed by Congress in 2014. Okay, the law was not devoted to this Resolution Copper Mine. It was one of those must-pass, can't-fail defense authorization acts in which this Resolution Copper Mine was added kind of in the middle of the night. Okay. And this said that, this is their interpretation, all they have to do is write the FEIS, and in 60 days, Rio Tinto gets the land free and clear. That's their interpretation, okay? that it didn't matter what the FAA said. Just write it, do something, and you get the land. Okay, that was why they said, no, it doesn't matter what the FAA said, which the judge, being a little incredulous, kept pushing on that. How could it not matter at all? But that's what they said. Okay. My own opinion is that it still has to be a valid FEIS, which it isn't at all. Okay? It's very deficient as an FEIS, and it really does matter what it says. Okay?
Would you like to add to that?
I thought you could better explain the section.
Okay.
Yeah, what matters is Rio Tinto, of course, wrote the land exchange legislation. And what they could have said is the land exchange is exempt from all environmental laws, but it didn't say that. So the Forest Service, the U.S. government, has to follow all of the laws in the National Environmental Policy Act, all the other environmental laws in writing the FEIS. And only if that is done, and therefore the FEIS is complete, then the land transfer can happen. And obviously our position is the FEIS is far from adequate, and so it doesn't pass that test, and the land exchange can't move forward. The other part of it is the FEIS is supposed to be the only document written on which to base the permits that Resolution Copper would still need for what still would be our land, the pipeline corridor to Skunk Camp, the power line corridors, the pipeline corridor from Superior along the Marco corridor, and all of that, the Forest Service does have the ability to say no to. So again, if you have an incomplete FEIS, you don't have the proper knowledge on which to base the decisions on whether to grant those pipelines and power lines. So there's that as well.
Go get Sylvia.
I think for me, to simplify it, that the National Forest Authorization Act of 2014, they said that regardless of what is wrong with this project, whether it depletes our water, whether it poisons all of us, that land exchange must be done. And so that is why we really have to stay alert on this subject. We really have to find ways to try to stop this, because the government, and we need to write to our legislators, our local ones, San Juan Valley, our town councils, our town council in Queen Creek. We need to pressure them, we need to pressure the state, the county. The county has jumped on, Pinal County has definitely jumped on this project, because they will gain money from that. But we need to jump on those things and stay on top of it, write our letters so that we can try to rescind that section of the National Defense Authorization Act. And that is where you will find it.
All right. Hey, everyone. My name is Enviga. I'm with Representative Adelita Grijalva's office, so I just came to learn more, and I'm really grateful that I was able to come from Tucson. I thank you for letting me have a moment to kind of share. So I do agree. I think that reaching out to your county supervisors, local electeds, is really, really important. I also work with Representative Mihama, which is a supervisor, and there's a lot you can do at the county level to prevent these land purchases. A lot of the times they can be stopped or prevented or held up at those local levels. But Adelita Grijalva's first bill, when she has recently been, you know, sworn in, was to protect Oak Flat. So that would repeal a provision that authorized the transfer of 2.4 acres, which includes Oak Flat, which also would prevent you know, this from happening, Resolution Copper. So I think it's super important that you reach out to your elected officials and get together and make sure that various people do so. It means a lot when there's a mass of people who are reaching out to the office, especially when they're your representative. Even if your representative isn't, you know, necessarily in agreement, just the fact that you're reaching out and making sure that you're organizing your community is super important. And again, I just want to stress, it's not only, you know, the federal level, but as well as, you know, your local elected officials. I think that that's a really, really big important piece. So I'll be here until the end of the meeting if you have any questions for me. Again, thank you so much for being here.
And you know what? Even that land swap, the land that they're going to swap, is also protected. It's the Mesquite Boss. I mean, Stephen can tell you a lot more about that. But even the land that they're going to swap for Stan Park, the Oak Patch should be protected as well.
Yes, please.
I just want to add, you're right. But
thank you.
Writing letters is the third most impactful thing you can do in pressuring a decision maker. The top thing you can do is try and get a meeting with them. You just need at least two more people besides yourself to get a meeting with, to try and get a meeting with them, and you know, be genuine about your concerns. You don't have to be an expert. Your objective is to try and make them cry or be angry about the issues. I grew up here in South Phoenix, but I've been in the DC area for a good chunk of my life. Going into their offices, just being genuine about their concerns, I've gotten within 2 weeks people who were even opponents to me, like moving legislation. So that's the top thing you can do, is try and get a meeting. The second most impactful thing is a phone call. And they gotta hear your emotions in the phone call. That is why it's impactful. And then the third, you know, it's further down in impact is the letter. But it has to be a genuine letter. A form letter to these people means nothing. So you gotta put in some work, because they recognize if you're not putting in work to tell them to do the right thing, they're like, whatever. So petitions, all that kind of stuff, you need to do more than that. The petitions are good organizing tools for letting the organizers know who's on their side. But they're also working to make sure you do the top three things that I've mentioned, which is to make a meeting, get a phone call, get phone calls in, and get those genuine letters in.
What's the name of this property that they're trying to buy? It's trust land, correct?
Oak Flat,
thank you.
There's two areas, right? So you have where they're going to get it from, and then where the water's coming. So it's both places that are affected. Arizona State Land and Oak Flat. Can I ask a question about the water?
Oh, please.
Mentioning, and thank you, everybody, for being here, at least, and for, let's go. So the mining water that they're allowed to get as
much as they want, where did that come from, and how is that not
going to be bought?
I'll let Roger review this.
I'm sorry, what? So, you know, because in the developments, they have to have, they used to, I mean, I think it got passed, they didn't have a lot of the water, like, for years, that they had to say they were going to be able to kind of get water supply. They had to, you know, say that they were going to provide that. So,
Are you talking about whether the requirements for housing developments, the 100-year required, how that compares with what Resolution Copper would be able to do? Because the in order to pass the groundwater improvement laws in the 80s, the legislators made a deal with the mining associations to exempt mining from those laws. So that's what happened there.
Well,
yeah, there's a lot we can do about it, and that is to get those laws changed and to close that loophole that mines aren't exempt from groundwater laws. But even before that, again, is to put pressure on the legislators in the state and the company itself at a board level that this is just simply not acceptable.
Is Kearney, where Brian was talking about, they're buying water? I just read in the newspaper that even now today, the mine in Kearney has first dibs on the water, even before the residents.
Yeah.
So Neil Carter is our state legislative representative, and he was planning on being here tonight, but he got held up in a Chamber of Commerce thing. I do have cards out in the car if you guys want his contact information. And Sylvia, if you want to coordinate or organize anything when we have a meeting and invite him and Michael Ray, I'll be more than happy to help you with that.
Hi, my name's Maria Salcido, and I live in Superior. So I'm listening to everything that's kind of happening here with Vistas, and you know, it takes your city councils, it takes your mayor, it takes your officials to do things, but it also takes the fact of you voting the right people in. Elections come around. You have to be mindful of the people that you're voting into these positions, because what's happening is that they get bought off. And the only reason why I'm saying that is because right now I'm getting ready to put my stuff on the plate to run for mayor for Superior.
Yeah.
But I also have people who want to give me money. I'm not one to take your money. I don't want your money. My job is to take care of the people, is how I look at it. I'm fourth generation Superior. I have six generations there total. I look at it from a different point of view because I'm about what's happening with my community, what's happening with the corruption of the water, what's happening with what if there's a fault line that's in Superior, for heaven's sakes. Or what happens if you don't have any economic development that happens within the community? Can they come in and do what's called eminent domain and take all of our properties? Because that's what they did in Ray and Sonora. So we have to look at things a little bit differently on our end, but it all depends on you. Everybody wants to talk about, like, our governor. Our governor's been there. She showed up there and didn't tell anybody in town that she was showing up. She told our mayor and our council, and she told the mine, but never bothered to tell the citizens of Superior. We also have Ruben Gallego. He showed up there, did not tell anybody that he was showing up, but he talked to the mine, and he also talked to the mayor and the council, and nothing was ever done about that either, and totally agrees with what needs to happen. We also have Mark Kelly. So when you look at everything and you talk about it, they're aware of the corruption. They're aware of everything, but they're receiving money from these companies as well under their super PACs. That's how they get elected. You have to raise $250,000, and then you have to be able to have corporations back you as well in order to even be on that ballot. So you think this is just about your community here and what's going to happen here? This is nothing. We have a whole community that's sitting there has no clue. 80% of those people in Superior have not a clue about what's happening up there.
Yeah,
so that's what the problem is. Nobody's talking. Nobody's having a conversation about it. Nobody's saying we need to fix what's happening with the corruption. You know, yeah, there's 40 people here, but every person talks to 10.
And there's an army of paid bots on social media. That anytime there's any kind of a post about the mine, these evil bots that are powered by automation come out and are just